Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Tuesday, September 2nd, 2014. And it feels like the fall of 2002, as a false rush to war is underway again. And the Islamic State announced the beheading of another American journalist it was holding. Hoping to goad the United States into another military misadventure on Islamic soil. And too many American leaders are supporting it. Plaintive cry of Bronski Beat. No more war, she says. And against that backdrop, we learn today of the killing of Stephen Sotloff, the second American journalist, held captive by the Islamic State and killed by decapitation. And it's possible that he was killed at the very same time as Jim Foley. We don't really know. There is quite a bit of evidence that the videos have been heavily doctored. And over the weekend, the Islamic State, sending a message to neighboring Lebanon, beheaded a Lebanese soldier who was one of 19 captured when militants seized a Lebanese border town for a few days last month. And there's no question that the Islamic State is a brutal organization, and that they revel in offending Western sensibilities. And I'm going to say something that may offend your Western sensibilities. But they're beheading these people because they know it makes our skin crawl. And in a conflict like the Syrian Civil War, like this regional war that is expanding, in that part of the globe, a death is a death. And these are grisly, barbaric acts that are supposed to produce an emotional reaction from Americans. And it works. Take, for example, the chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who also happens to be my senior senator from California. Her name is Dianne Feinstein. And on Meet the Press Sunday, she was interviewed by Andrea Mitchell.
The president back in January told The New Yorker magazine, David Remnick, that ISIS is the JV team. That was clearly wrong.
Well, I think it's wrong, too. I think it's a major varsity team, and if you want to use those kinds of monikers. But I've seen nothing that compares with its viciousness. I've been on the Intelligence Committee now since before 9/11, and I've watched this evolution of non-state actors into world terror very carefully and closely. And this is really the first group that has the wherewithal in terms of financing, the fighting machine in terms of a structure, heavy equipment, heavy explosives, the ability to move quickly. They crossed the border into Iraq before we even knew it happened.
So here you have a fear-up statement from Dianne Feinstein, and she joins a chorus of angry voices in Washington, led by John McCain and Lindsey Graham. And Graham and McCain published an op-ed that appeared in Saturday's New York Times, headline, "Stop Dithering, Confront ISIS." And they misstate history. They attempt to spin up IS as the world's most sinister terrorist army. And that Obama's admission, which was a blunder on his part last week, that we don't have a strategy yet, is startling and dangerous. And they go on to attack the president for being too cautious, and Feinstein says the same. But later in their op-ed, they say, no one is advocating unilateral invasion, occupation, or nation building. Well, what are you advocating? This is simply ad hominem attacks on the president. As the intelligence and military communities appear to be building a case for expansive military action by the United States, and in particular, crossing over into Syria. And the president, to his credit, has avoided that, even at the expense last year of his red line and then submitting to Congress of whether we're going to get involved militarily in Syria and then backing down when Russia brokered the agreement for Syria to shed its chemical weapons. But there's much more to this story that McCain and Graham and Feinstein conveniently don't mention. And that, of course, is the history of failed American policies that led to the creation of groups like the Islamic State. Where did they get their guns? Where did they get their early organization? In the war on Libya. A misguided adventure, if there ever was one. And this article is very carefully sourced. And as I say that, I have to tell you that I'm going to link to it so you can read it for yourself. It's from an outfit called SCG News. And there's no indication of exactly who they are or where they are. It appears that SCG stands for Storm Clouds Gathering. And it's written with a kind of British English. That's the best I can tell you about its sourcing and who actually wrote this. But I read it very carefully, and I didn't find anything in it that is inaccurate or not well sourced. They rely heavily on the occasional work of Seymour Hersh, who published an article in April of this year referring to the Rat Line. That was the covert network used to channel weapons and ammunition from Libya through southern Turkey and across the Syrian border. And that was a deal between the CIA, Turkey, and the Syrian rebels. The article also makes the clear point that this fiction that the U.S. could arm the responsible rebel groups, or as Carl Levin referred to them, the vetted moderates, is just bullshit. Because the Free Syrian Army, which we claim to support, has been honest that they conduct joint operations with al-Nusra, the one that is always described as the al-Qaeda-linked rebel group in Syria. And al-Nusra was supporting the Islamic State people until they had a falling out. And IS clearly is willing to overrun the other rebel groups and to take their weapons, supplied by the United States via Libya. And so the U.S. fingerprints are all over IS. We know that at least a third of their leadership were Sunnis who were imprisoned during the de-Ba'athification of Iraq under Paul Bremer, the Bush occupation. And they were hardened and radicalized while they were jailed under U.S. auspices. And some of those people we openly supported or actively supported, maybe covertly more than openly, when their guns were trained on the forces of Bashar al-Assad. And so these people who now say, do something, Obama, were all parties to these bad policy agreements that have now left us in this ugly situation where grisly beheadings are announced all too often. And if you don't find SCG credible, here's Press TV interviewing an American who says he's a former CIA contractor. Stephen Kelly lives in Anaheim, California. He says that the ISIL terrorist group is a completely fabricated enemy created and funded by the United States. Quote, the funding is completely from the U.S. and its allies, and for people to think that this enemy is something that needs to be attacked in Syria or Iraq is a farce, because obviously this is something that we created, we control, and now it has become inconvenient for us to attack this group as a legitimate enemy. And so the outlines are very clear. We are on a path for a repeat of the manipulation of public opinion around fears of gruesome beheadings. The one thing that Feinstein didn't repeat is her constant fear-mongering that some of the Americans who've gone to fight in Syria, and some of them went there when it was okay to support IS because they hadn't turned on the U.S. and they hadn't invaded Iraq. As long as their mayhem was limited to Syria, well, the fact that some Americans went to fight for them is actually somewhat understandable. And so now we have to fear up, activate the police state apparatus. Britain is talking about grabbing passports from suspects. And the beat goes on and on. And with our midterm elections looming, the Democrats on track to lose the Senate, maintain a minority in the House of Representatives, Obama and the Democrats are increasingly desperate. And they're trying to corral African American voters in key states to try to preserve the Senate majority. But frankly, I don't see it in the cards. And so we turn to the war machine, we fear people up, and hope that people don't want to change horses in the middle of the stream, in the middle of a war. It's really scary. It truly is. And I will mention again that Thursday will be my last podcast this week, and I'm going to take about 3 weeks off for lengthy foreign travel. And my concern is that while I'm enjoying myself exploring an exotic destination, and I'll tell you about it afterward, okay, is that all hell is going to break loose. Meanwhile, on Sunday, Israel announced that it will expropriate, or, you know, just acquire, 4 square kilometers, which is about 1.5 square miles of Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank. This is believed to be the largest seizure by Israel in 30 years. And this comes at the same time as a group of peaceful Palestinians who've built an entire new village on the West Bank. It's got a little soccer stadium. It's got everything. But Israel controls the water supply, and Israel has refused to turn it on. And in the same breath, they announce they're grabbing more Palestinian land. It just shows that Israel has no intention of settling with its neighbors in a peaceful manner. They will continue their aggression. And this is what pushes the Palestinian leadership of Fatah, Mahmoud Abbas, to float the idea that he will speak at the United Nations in a week or two. During the General Assembly, he's going to ask the UN to set a date for an end of the Israeli occupation and the blockade of Gaza. Now, the Palestinians, I think, are being very generous. They're floating the idea of a 3-year deadline. 3 years? 3 more years of this occupation they're willing to accept? I mean, I'd start with 2 weeks and do some negotiation. But I suppose that's what they think is realistic under the circumstances. Well, it's described as relatively calm along the Russia-Ukraine border today, but the war of words is heating up. As Vladimir Putin is steaming mad, claiming that a private diplomatic conversation that he had has been leaked to the public and that it has been taken out of context. The comment taken out of context is, if I wanted to, I could take Kiev in 2 weeks. The remark made in a private phone call to José Manuel Barroso, who is a European Union official. And the Russian government announced that they have an audio recording and a written transcript of the conversation that they're threatening to release unless Mr. Barroso comes clean. And honestly, while what Putin is saying is annoying and certainly makes him a braggart, it seems pretty true to me. And we were told last week that Russia had invaded the eastern portion of Ukraine, and we're still waiting to see any real evidence of that. Now, there's no question that there are these, you know, fighters who appear to be Russians using unmarked Russian equipment. But however Putin is managing this in a kind of stealthy hide-and-seek manner, the U.S. continues its missteps, blunders in making accusations that it can't prove. And it plays into the hands of Mr. Putin. In my view, there's just no doubt about that. Every day I like to pause to mention the people who make this podcast possible with their monthly subscription donations. People like Don Cisney, Steve Lane, Julie Dupree does more than she has to, and Bob Getzla, a very longtime loyal subscriber. So I invite you to join them. Over the weekend, two people canceled their subscriptions and no new subscriptions arrived on my in my email. So I'd invite you to join in. Come on over to peterbcollins.com. And if you're solvent, hey, click on the link under my picture that says sign up. You choose $5, $10, $20 a month, or our best deal, the $50 annual subscription. And new annual subscribers in the U.S. get a copy of John Diss' rock and roll CD called Red Flag with our compliments. Now, the other side of the war, a war of words related to Ukraine, is coming from NATO. And this Thursday, President Obama will meet with NATO leaders in a locked-down Cardiff, Wales. And NATO leaders will be asked to approve the creation of a high-readiness force and the stockpiling of military equipment supplies in Eastern Europe. And while the President of the United States has flatly said there will be no American military action in Ukraine, Europeans are treating this like, well, like the run-up to World War II. And this, of course, heightens tensions and the prospect of a mistake that could lead to an open conflict. Well, that increases on a daily basis. While you were barbecuing yesterday and knocking back a six-pack, American drones struck in Somalia, and we claim that we took out the leader of Al-Shabaab. His name is Ahmed Abdi Godane. And one American official in Nairobi, Kenya, said, "We're 80% sure that we killed him." But there were no boots on the ground, so we'll have to wait and see if that death is acknowledged. And while Al-Shabaab is a regional irritant, a terrorist group, I don't believe there is any real risk to the United States posed by Al-Shabaab. And this is more freelance military action, a new front, or another front. And the blowback from these activities is what I fear more than the risk of Al-Shabaab. A couple of items related to our grisly treatment and barbaric treatment of individuals under the guise of the so-called war on terror. Last week, the New York Times tweaked the Obama White House. Because back in 2009, the newly installed president said he wanted to release all of the photos from Abu Ghraib. And there's some 2,000 that we still haven't seen, and we're told they're much worse than the Lindy England, Charlie Grainer stuff that we saw that was released when back in around 2007. And the Obama administration reversed itself back in 2009, and a law was passed by Congress to prevent the release of these, we were told, at the behest of the Maliki government in Baghdad. Well, Maliki's history now. And there is no pending request from the Iraqis not to release these photos. And they're locked up like the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report. Now a federal judge has blocked a request from the Center for Constitutional Rights to release images of Mohammed al-Qahtani, who was allegedly going to be the 20th hijacker on September 11th, and who was subjected to interrogation techniques that included torture. He was the target of a special interrogation plan that included 20-hour interrogation, sleep deprivation, prolonged exposure to cold temperatures, forced nudity, performance of dog tricks while wearing a dog collar, sexual humiliation, and writing for a 3-judge panel. The decision was that release of the photos could logically and plausibly harm national security. Why? Because they're susceptible to use by anti-American extremists as propaganda. Well, maybe we should have thought of that about that before we conducted these torture programs. And here's a courageous man who has resigned his commission in the U.S. military. His name is Major Jason Wright, and on August 26th, he submitted his resignation. Not only as a defense lawyer at Gitmo, but his commission in the military completely. Why? Because he objected to an attempt to transfer him in the middle of his representation of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and the other 4 so-called high-value detainees accused of masterminding the 9/11 events. And Wright, in a great interview with NPR's All Things Considered, really told the truth to the extent that he could. He said, Mohammed has faced a level of torture beyond comprehension. He said his client was waterboarded 183 times, subjected to over a week of sleep deprivation, threats that his family would be killed. And those are just the declassified facts that I'm able to actually speak about, says Wright. So he tells the story of how it took him a long time to win the confidence of his clients. And then they dangled a promotion in front of Wright, which he deferred one time, and this second time they said, no, you can't defer it. So basically, they're going to promote him out of his job defending Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and others, and he believes that that is by design. He goes on to say that the fact that the CIA tortured these men and that they've gone to extraordinary lengths to try to keep that completely hidden from public view. Not only do you have statutory design, but you actually have in practice a very large effort to try to ensure that no information about torture is ever made known to the public. The U.S. government, quote, is trying to call this a fair trial while stacking the deck so much against the defense and the accused that it can hardly be called a fair trial in any system in the world. Leave aside our constitutional principles, says Jason Wright, which we should try to uphold irrespective of who the defendant might be. The Constitution has been completely stepped on throughout this entire process. We have a system where if someone's acquitted, they will not be set free. That is actually the very definition of a show trial. Jason Wright, you're an American hero. Thanks for speaking the truth. I don't consider the president a hero. He took the opportunity of Labor Day to travel to Milwaukee, where he curiously limited his remarks, at least based on the coverage I've seen, to promotion of an increase in the minimum wage. Now, I fully support an increase in the minimum wage. And the Democrats have raised it this year purely for political reasons. They can't get a minimum wage increase through the Republican-controlled House, and they know it. But they keep talking about it, and the president used his authority to give a minimum wage increase, a raise, to a number of federal contractor employees. But he's got a lot of nerve, in my opinion, to go to Wisconsin and be greeted by Republican Governor Scott Walker when he arrived in Milwaukee. Walker, who has decimated organized labor, and in particular, the public employee unions in Wisconsin, and the president never lifted a finger. This is the same guy who went with Joe Biden to Ohio, I think it was 2010, and offered tepid support for voters' repeal of a right-to-work law. I think it was Senate Bill 5, or had the number 5. And this was the president who, when he campaigned back in 08, said he'd be there with members of labor. He'd make sure that card check became the policy at the National Labor Relations Board. And he hasn't done a goddamn thing. He has never put 1 ounce of his political capital to work to prevent right-to-work laws in Michigan and rollback of union rights in almost a dozen states. And that's why I say he's got a lot of nerve to show up in Wisconsin and claim to fight for workers over a minimum wage increase that is purely a campaign ploy. And finally today, Labor Day saw the mass escape of 32 juveniles from Woodland Hills, an allegedly maximum security juvenile prison in Tennessee.
Tonight there's gonna be a jailbreak somewhere in this town. See, me and the boys, we don't like it, so we're getting up and going down. Looking right to left. If you see us coming, I think it's best to move away. Do you hear what I say? From under my breath.
Now, I don't support wanton law breaking, and I don't support prison breaks in most cases. But this is pretty remarkable. Nearly half of the population of this detention center escaped. 32 of them got into the yard and then escaped through a weak spot in the fence. 8 are still at large at our deadline today. And one of the reasons why I'm reporting on this is that Woodland Hills has in recent years been the subject of a wrongful death lawsuit, sex abuse allegations, and a smaller breakout attempt earlier this year. Tennessee paid a $250,000 settlement for a wrongful death lawsuit brought by the father of one of the prisoners. And a 2010 investigation by a newspaper showed that sex abuse allegations have plagued the facility, which has some of the highest rates of sexual victimization of any U.S. juvenile center. I hope authorities will pay close attention here and not just punish those who escaped or who conceived of this escape plan, but address the obvious problems at Woodland Hills. We'll let Phil and the boys from Thin Lizzy play out the show today. Thanks for listening. I'm Peter B. Collins.
Break out! Night.
our systems fail. Hey, you